Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. The first application to go over, or the package rather, is KIcon Themes. And this is relatively easy to guess, the nature of this thing. It is indeed a library containing classes to improve the handling of icons and applications using the KDE framework. I bet you thought it was going to be a bunch of icons. Well, we've already done the icons. Remember that was Breeze, the Breeze theme and things like that. So I'm pretty sure all the icons were bundled in that. This is a helper class such that your KDE application is able to find and use the correct icons as dictated by the system settings. Icons are a funny thing. I think there's a prevailing attitude out there that your system should be mostly unified in terms of its look and feel, and icons are a big part of that. That's what many of us are looking at all the time when we're searching for an application to launch, for instance. You go to your K menu or whatever menu you're using, there are often icons by the menu selections, and that's because of some, you know, I don't know, physiological/psychological aptitude that humans have to quickly embody an idea in a picture. And so icons help us identify really quickly a certain concept or a certain, in this case, application that we want to launch. So they're very useful. But stylistically, a lot of times we, I think, again, just as kind of humans using computers, we have decided, many of us have decided, that there should be some kind of unifying style to what we have to look at. And that can be tricky. I think one theory is that, well, the platform ought to publish sort of a set of guidelines and tell people, this is what we expect your icon to look like. These are the rules. This is the color palette. This is the rough shape. We prefer rounded edges to square edges, or we prefer square edges to rounded edges. Don't use a letter or a number in your icon, and so on, whatever the rules might be. And then you have people designing icons that are mostly sort of like within that space. They have a certain conformity to them. But then, of course, you've got the third party, you know, what the third party application, which what is a third party application ever? But in this case, it's one of the outliers. It's one of the applications that says, you know what, I don't care about your icon style, or I didn't really intend my application to be run on your operating system, so I never gave any thought to your icon guidelines, and so here's my icon, or worse yet, maybe here's a bunch of different icons within my application, and so then, you know, you've got the exception, you've got that one outlier, and then maybe your icon designers kind of come up and sort of come up with an alternative icon for that one application. But you multiply that to the extent of the open source applications out there now, and it's just an impossible task. And there have been efforts in the past to unify application sets, you know, to actually essentially cover all known applications. You know, here's an icon for everything that you could possibly launch. And what a interesting effort that is. And I don't think it generally works. But that's one theory, right? The other theory is that maybe you give the user control, so that if the user needs to unify their applications a little bit more, then you give them the ability to easily change the icons. And that's fine. That works until you get into questions of, well, these icons right here are embedded in the code. They're compiled into the application. They're not looking to the system to gather icons. They're there. So it gets complex. It gets really complex. And it's frustrating, I think, for a lot of people who want sort of that unified experience, especially for people who come from a platform that may have fostered a very, very insular experience. Then the illusion often is that, well, all of my icons always match. My system is completely unified. And maybe that is true for some people, you know, people who are using a very specific ecosystem of applications from a very specific set of vendors. Maybe it all goes together and it just kind of works. But I think that in the free range computing world, if I may coin a term off the cuff, you don't really get that. You don't get that. You don't get the super easy, or you're not satisfied rather by the insular computing experience. Now, that said, I have stated relatively accurately when I upgraded to Slackware 15, is that what I'm running now? What Slackware are we on anyway? I have no clue. I think it's 15. Let me just verify that. I feel like I'm somehow have lost track of what world I'm living in. 15.0. Wow. I haven't thought about that in ages. And now that I have, it's blowing my mind because I've been on 14 for so long. 15. When did that happen? Well, anyway, I did a bunch of shows about it, so I guess I should actually be aware of it. When I upgraded to Slackware 15, one of the things that I found myself doing was not installing a bunch of extra applications that I usually install for one reason or another. I have since that time installed here or there, you know, a couple of applications that I normally have. But in general, I have settled into a bunch of sort of a predictable set of applications, all of them with very nice icons available to them, and many of them designed by the same sort of group. So a lot of my icons are coming from the KDE icon set just for free. They're just there, and they all kind of conform to the same look and feel because they're designed by the same group. In other words, I feel like in the modern open source world, I feel like a lot of icons have kind of converged into a comfortable kind of sameness, which, you know, normally I might not say that as a good thing. Being the same, being too similar, that's often not a good thing. But for visual cohesion, these icons being relatively similar, it's kind of working for me, and it's kind of nice, and I don't remember it necessarily being the case previously. Counterpoint to that, though. Previously, I think I strove for a more severe visual cohesion, because to me, back way, 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 way a long time ago, when I was, you know, like, for me, changing your icon set was a hack. It was the sign of a power user. It was something that you did to show that you were aware that you were using a computer. All those other people out there with the default icons, what a bunch of suckers they were. If you changed your icon set, you demonstrated to people that you knew how to get in and out of file systems and you knew how to do things. So for me, at some point in my life, a long time ago, the idea of being able to kind of assemble a pretend supercomputer, you know, that you make out of cardboard boxes, except it's not made out of cardboard boxes. It's something that you do graphically on your computer. You make your computer look like you want it to feel. And so drastic icon changes were something that I was quite fond of for a while. And I don't know how well it ever worked, to be honest. And on Linux, I feel like you can still do that. You can select, you know, any given launcher and get properties on it, and then put in your own icon for the little for the icon that it uses, and you're good to go. You've got your own little custom icon set. But as I say, in reality, there are icons within applications, and there are icons in scrolled away in little places that are compiled in or that are just out of your immediate purview, and it just kind of starts to fall apart. So I think the place where Linux is right now with icons is actually a really nice, comfortable place. And while there are icon sets out there that can change things up, a lot of times the icon sets out there don't account for the icon sets required by this desktop that you're running or that desktop that you might want to run tomorrow. And so you get little quirks and missing icons or weirdness like getting a, I don't know, a web browser assigned to your system setting icon for some weird reason, you know, just like quirks and hiccups here and there. And so I really do feel like having a, if you want the unification, having a really good desktop like KDE or GNOME that has an eye on sort of the bigger picture, it is a big, big help. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have unified visual cohesion elsewhere. You could do it in, I don't know, XFCE. That might be perfectly fine doing that. I actually don't know. I am running XFCE on my Magia desktop over in my wardrobe, but everyone keeps a desktop computer in their wardrobe, don't they? But I haven't experimented around with icons all that much. But certainly like something like Fluxbox, where you're essentially building everything yourself, I mean, then you get to build it yourself. You get to figure out what icons you want to use, and internal icons within applications that are compiled in are just something completely different. So it's a complex thing to casually say, oh, I think I'd like to change icons now, or I think I'd like to change the theme of my icons. KIcon Theme tries to help applications manage that. It tries to help your KDE applications that you're writing know that the icon theme has changed. You're using something different now. And then, of course, you get into questions of fallbacks. Well, what if you can't find that system settings gear icon? What do you use instead? How do you determine what a good fit for a fallback would be? What category is there? It can be really, really tricky. And I think I mentioned on the Breeze, I think it was the Breeze one, the episode that I was talking about, the Breeze icon set, I think I mentioned that, you know, back a long time ago on computers, there weren't custom icons for a lot of things. Oh no, it was the Dolphin episode, I think, where the thumbnail or FFmpeg thumbnailer or something. There was a time in computing where you didn't have really icons that were descriptive beyond, this looks like a document of some sort, so it must be a file that I can open. This icon looks like a folder, so it must contain documents. Those were your two icons, if you were lucky. That was it. And you know, maybe this is a diamond-shaped icon. That must mean it's an executable. There's your icon set. And now it's so much more rich, but the price there is that it is so much more complex. Okay, that's probably enough about KIcon Theme. Let's talk about KID3, or KID3. I think I was talking about this when I was praising Elisa, Elisa. Elisa is a really nice little music player. It is written in QML instead of Qt, it is Qt, but it's QML rather than, I guess, C++, technically speaking. Although, we're going to get into a question of cascading foundational things. But anyway, Elisa is, it's a nice application. It is a lot less customizable in terms of the UI than, say, Amarok was, which for me is what Elisa is replacing. So, but it is a beautiful application as well. And so I spent weeks going through my entire music collection, tagging things, getting album art, making sure that everything had a cover.jpg in the album directory. I did the whole thing for lots and lots of albums because I wanted to open up Elisa and to be able to see just a virtual shelf of all my albums by art and by artist and by album name and so on. It took me a long time, and I will admit that the application that I used to tag all of my music, and you have to understand, a lot of my music was not tagged because I did not use tags this is the first time I've used tags. This is the first time I've actually used an application that was looking at my music according to tag and not file structure. I have always preferred just seeing, I prefer to see the file structure because then I can arbitrarily organize things. I can put, you know, these five albums that share nothing in common except the time and place when I first heard them, I can put those into a directory, and that's that. You know, so that's how I like to organize my music. It's not, it doesn't have to be alphabetical or logical or anything. It's just how I want to present it to myself. So this is the first time I've used tags, and in order to tag all those albums, hundreds of albums, I used a little application called EasyTag, which you'll notice is not KID3. I like KID3. I have always used KID3 in the past because it was just there. And I'll probably continue to use it in the future, for this and that. I ended up using EasyTag because I think it just kept coming up. And I think there was a question of it tagging, there's some format that at the time when I started this project, I don't know that KID3 was tagging. I could be making that up. It might have been the Opus format. And now I don't know. It's probably fine now. But KID3 is a graphical tagging application. So if you've got an album, if you've got music, and you want KID3, or if you want to tag it with metadata, KID3 is one way that you could do that. It is a pretty self-explanatory application, I think. You open it up, you can open a file in it, and so then it becomes sort of aware of the directory that contains that file. And you select the song that you want to tag, or the group of songs, you know, the several songs, if they all share an attribute such as, I don't know, the artist name. You select those songs, you know, just a click, shift click, select the artist in the tag version that you want to tag it with, type in the artist name, and then maybe the album name, and then you can stop selecting them all, and you just select one, and you put in, for instance, the title, and then you go to the next file, and you put in the title, and so on. So, I mean, it's really, really self-explanatory. When you are finished, you save your changes, it writes that metadata back to the files, and you're done. You can continue about your day, or you can continue tagging other albums all day if you want. The navigation is a little bit peculiar, possibly. It took me a little while to catch on to it, but the northwest quadrant is, that panel contains the files, although not always the files, it's always also directories. And then the bottom, the southwest quadrant contains like the parent of whatever's in the top left panel, the northwest panel. So it kind of makes sense in a weird way, because the one that you're sort of paying attention to is the one in the upper left, in the northwest quadrant. But of course, you know, I say quadrant, and actually there's only three panels. But anyway, the top left, that's the one you're sort of paying attention to. And that's a natural place for your eye to fall, I think, left to right. So here's an album. There's a song. I can click on it. All of the data appears in the right panel, in the right hand panel. That's a big panel with a bunch of tag options. So that's kind of your main control panel. But then to back out and go to another album, you have to go down. You have to look down to the bottom left and click either the double dot. Well, really, you click the two dots, just like in Bash. You cd space dash a dot dot. That's here. So dot dot, go to the parent directory, and then you're out. And if you want to go further back, you hit the dots again. So it's got kind of a, I don't know, I guess, what is that? Like an almost an old school navigational system. It feels very kind of like early Unix. Well, not super early, but, you know, early X11 sort of navigation conventions. Like there's no icon. There's no arrow or anything like that. You just double dots to go to the next location. But yeah, so that might take some getting used to. It took a little bit of getting used to for me, but generally speaking, it's not that complex, and it does work. And in practice, at least for me, I often end up opening KID3 to a specific file. I very rarely open KID3 and then navigate to the place that I want to go. It's usually the other way. I usually have found a track that didn't get tagged, right-click, open in KID3, and then do the changes. And I have actually been defaulting to KID3 lately. I guess again, probably because it just comes up. Maybe I'm not really sure even why I do that. It really just depends. There is no logic to it. It seems to be whatever's in the right-hand menu, or the right-click menu. If it's Easy Tag, then I go to Easy Tag. If it's KID3, then I go to KID3. They're both equally capable, I think, and they're both great little applications that make tagging as, I guess, sort of functional as it possibly can be right now. I've said before, I don't think we are really getting the most out of metadata. I don't think it's as easy to interact with as it could be. So I'm not overly happy with any application, unfortunately, that deals with metadata, because I just don't feel like it's integrated enough. But that's not really the fault of the application. The applications are doing their best. You know, things like KID3 and EasyTag, they're doing great. They're trying to work with metadata. It's, I feel like, the OS, the file systems, the rest of us just aren't really, really, like, making metadata a part of our lives. Okay, let's talk about K-Identity Management. That'll be relatively easy, because I don't have a whole lot to say about it. It's a little library that just manages your identity within KDE PIM, the Personal Information Management Suite. So this sort of, from what I can tell, and you know, I haven't written code that calls this library, so I can't speak very precisely about what it does. But from what I can tell, looking over the file list and glancing at the header files, it looks like this essentially ensures that when an application says to use a signature, that it knows who the current user is and where their signature is located. And by signature, I mean, you know, like a signature for like an email, for instance, which, as far as I know, is the only thing that actually uses the signature in KDE. But I could be wrong. There could be something else. But there are a couple of different options for identity, you know, like sort of identifying features, as it were, of your environment. And K-Identity Management is the thing that ensures a KDE application has quick access to the correct information. All right, next is K-Idle Time, a singleton reporting information on idle time. Useful not only for finding out about the current idle time of a system, but also for getting notified upon idle time events, such as custom timeouts or user activity. This is funny if you really think about it, and you know, you might not think that a computer would necessarily or should necessarily care about, well, idle time. So it's essentially negative space. It's the things that aren't happening. It's the thing it's the input that it's not receiving. That feels like that's not something you would have to account for in a computer. Who cares if you're not doing a thing? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Why should your computer care? Well, as it turns out, there are a bunch of reasons it should care. It might need to care for timing a screensaver. It might want to care in order to detect whether, you know, it's asking you for confirmation on something and you're not providing it. How long do we wait before we just assume that, you know, one way or the other? I mean, I don't know what we would assume, but you can assume either, you know, silence means yes or silence means no, and then act accordingly. But then you have to find that silence. It might matter if you tell your computer not to do something despite idle time, which, I mean, you know, if we weren't accounting for idle time at all, then I guess you would never have to tell your computer not to account for it. But because there are events that care about the lack of input, then you are able to tell the computer to ignore the lack of input under certain circumstances. So if you're just playing a movie on your screen while you're off doing something else, but you want that movie on in the background, how do you tell your computer not to you know, shut off or rest, you know, black the screen or whatever? So yeah, there are weird use cases for the things that you are not doing. And K-Idle Time is a library for the KDE framework to help KDE kind of understand when things are not happening and for how long that has been the case. All right, speaking of idle time, I don't really count coffee time as idle time. It's a pretty productive time in the day of my day. But why don't we go for some theoretical idle time? Go grab a cup of coffee. We'll come back and finish up the show. Welcome back, coffee drinker. As we drink coffee, let's talk a little bit about some listener email. I got an email from Dan, very, very useful email from Dan. And I don't know which Dan this is. It's not Dan Washko, I don't think. Different Dan. And he says, enjoying the cast from the burning hot northern hemisphere. Sorry, Dan. It is quite cold down here in the south, as you can imagine. Seems nicer down under right now. Yes, I think so. Responding to your I-18N comment on GNU World Order 472, this is an abbreviation for internationalization. And he has the S and the Z sort of in brackets. Very clever. And it says I plus 18 letters plus N. So this is from, you can read more about this on Wikipedia, wikipedia.org/wiki/internationalization_and_, I have to scroll horizontally to read the rest of that, and localization. You may have also seen M17N, L10N, L12Y, and A16Z. One of these is less like the others. Please keep up the good work. So I don't know why I don't think to look on Wikipedia for basic questions like this. I apologize, dear listener. But also, it is kind of fascinating to meet the people who do answer. So that's fun. But yeah, so I-18-N, 18 stands for the number of letters between the first I and the last N in the word internationalization, a usage coined at Digital Equipment Corporation in the 70s or 80s. It's fascinating. So L10N is for localization. And again, L and then O-C-A-L-I-Z-A-T-I-O. And then there's N. So I mean, is that an answer? Really? I mean, is that an answer? I don't know. Like, why? Why was that a thing? It's really funny. If you worked at Digital Equipment Corporation in the 70s or 80s and know why people were referring to internationalization as I-18N and localization as L10N, do write in and let me know. Because I don't understand the convention, but it's super clever. I do like it. In fact, I love it. It is the same. That has the same wacky charm as recursive acronyms for me. Like that's funny and strange and a lot of fun. So and I don't know. You know, I don't know. Maybe there's an argument against that. Maybe that's not a good idea. Maybe that's obscure. Maybe it's obtuse. I don't know. But it, you know, it's one of those things where ever since being a Linux user, I have known what I-18N refers to. I've always known that, like, not literally always, but, you know, I remember seeing that early on and understanding somehow, and I don't remember how. I don't remember if someone told me. I don't remember if I read it. I don't remember if it was just in context, like, oh, I-18N, I have no idea what that is. Oh, but they're talking about a bunch of different languages. Okay, I-18N probably has something to do with international stuff. And then you see it again and again, and then you finally catch on. So eventually you figure out what it is, and I just think it's super clever. I like it. I love it when acronyms or titles have a little bit of a puzzle to them, even though I didn't solve the puzzle in this case. But I do like that. I think that's a fun thing. I'm not saying it can't be overdone. It could probably be overdone. I'm not saying it's intuitive. It's not intuitive. But then again, like, it is an easier way to write internationalization than internationalization. You have to admit that. It's a big word. It's a big, big word. Okay, so that is, that's more information about KI-18N from 472. The next application in our list is KIG, K-I-G, otherwise known as KDE Interactive Geometry. This is specifically part of the K educational suite of applications, and it is geared towards high school students who want to experiment around with geometry, as so many high school students do. I want to experiment around with geometry because it is a class that, I mean, I'm sure I had a geometry class in school, but didn't excel. So knowing more about geometry is definitely an interest of mine. And KIG Kig is it has proven fun to mess around with. I don't know that I'm getting everything out of it that I'm sort of like supposed to be getting out of it. I want to see probably more numbers than so far I have been able to find. Maybe that's not the point though, you know. I mean, it could be that maybe I'm trying to equate it too much to numbers. I just thought, you know, from classes that was what you were supposed to think about when you thought about shapes and lines and Bezier curves and things like that. So KIG, for the first couple of hours that I messed around with it, I really was struggling to understand sort of why I would use KIG, KIG, whatever, over, say, Inkscape. Because really, the activities that you're doing in KIG are a lot like Inkscape. And I just kept thinking, well, why would I want to draw shapes and do things in this application, which isn't terribly, it doesn't really make it all that easy to do. So why would I want to do that when I could instead just use Inkscape? Or learn SVG, you know, by code. Just write the XML. Just literally write XML that uses the SVG namespace and render things that way. So I wasn't really quite getting it. And then once I started moving objects around within this space, I realized sort of the strength of this application, which is, you know, and I still don't 100% understand the lesson plan here. I don't think I've cracked how to approach KIG properly, which makes sense because I'm the target audience. Well, not specifically, I'm not a high school student, but I'm someone who might want to look at this to learn more about geometry. And I do feel like this would be a great tool for someone who knew geometry and decided to teach it, you know, with a tool that could illustrate certain lessons. And it's a dynamic space. It's a much more dynamic space than you realize. You're not just drawing shapes on a whiteboard. You are drawing shapes that you can then transform and move, often in relation to one another. And that is really, really fascinating. So you can select just some points in your canvas and choose to move those points, and other points that you've not selected stay anchored. So let's say I draw a line from the objects lines, line by 2 points menu option. And there's a toolbar along the side as well, but I found it easier to just go to objects, find the object type that you want, and then draw that. So if I draw a line by defining 2 points, first of all, I do get the sense, I get the understanding from that process that the line goes on forever. So I understand that I've defined 2 points, but the trajectory, as it were, there's probably some kind of fancy geometry term for that. But like the line, you know, after the points, it keeps going into eternity because that's the line. That's it's defined, and it just keeps going unless you add another point and redirect it or something. Or maybe that's not how geometry works. Maybe technically that line keeps going, but even, you know, if you fork it somewhere, then you have essentially two lines. I don't know. I don't know the technicalities, but it's there. The line is there. And I get the sort of the immediate lesson that I've drawn 2 points, and between those 2 points and beyond those 2 points, a line can be drawn. And therefore, if you have two lines on your canvas that don't intersect in your current window, but looks like they're starting to intersect at some point, you can make your window a little bit bigger, and oh, there it is. There's the intersection, and there they cross over, they cross the streams, and now they're going. They continue into eternity. So that's a nice little visual display, which again you don't get in like a plain SVG, where you're drawing a line and the line is exactly what you have drawn. You've drawn a line or a segment of a line, and that's it. That's all you see. So that was good. That was interesting, a sort of interesting realization for me. But the cool thing is now I have 2 points on this particular line. So if I select one of those points, it turns red, and I can move it, and the other point stays anchored. So now I'm just kind of moving this line on kind of a swivel, on a pivot, and I get to see what happens to the rest of the line. What if I move the point closer? What if I move the line such that it's, going along the y-axis instead of sort of diagonal across the x and the y, or maybe I could just make it horizontal along the x-axis, and so on. So that was kind of fun to experience. But what's really cool, too, is that you can then, let's say I'll go to object and go to, where's the circle? Circles and arcs. And again, I'm a simple person, so I'm just going to grab a circle. And I draw a circle, you click, and then you kind of get to define the diameter of the circle by just dragging. You don't click and drag, you just drag. So I've defined the center point, and then you drag out, and you anchor it somewhere. So now you have two points on your circle. And once again, if you select, for instance, just that outer circle, then you can resize the circle. If you select both points, obviously, you can click the origin point and move that around. But you can also select, and this is when it gets really crazy, you can select like the circle and the line, and you can move the circle and one of the dots on the line. And so now the line is on a pivot, but you're moving the circle and this other dot sort of in relation to that pivot. And so you get to see the interaction of those things moving in relation to one another. I have no idea if I'm learning anything from this, but it's really cool. And one of the unexpected things that I don't know if learning is the correct term, but something that was fun to experience was this kind of really fascinating, spontaneous construction that I was able to do with just a circle and a line again, and I'm doing it right now. But if you anchor the line to the circle, you know, just by selecting, you can mimic a little bit of a mechanical system there. You can create like a gear, pulling or moving a lever. And so you can build almost simple machines with this, and it's fascinating to see the interaction of the objects. Now, again, I don't know if that's the sort of the right lesson to be taking away from this. It's probably not. There's probably a bunch of math stuff that I'm completely missing here, and it would be fascinating, I guess, to try, you know, more things with it, but and to sort of, yeah, maybe delve into the other, I don't know, functions of this application. But I will admit that I don't have the background for it. But the manual, the handbook for KIG is pretty good. I read it pretty, I think, to the end. And I mean, as far as I can tell, the use case is more or less what I was using it for, which is just to draw stuff. And then potentially the one thing that I didn't try from the manual was the macro functions. So you can create macros as well. And then you can create shapes and then create macros to instantly replicate those shapes later on. So you can define your own sort of like, yeah, shapes and have those easily repeatable if you want to. And there are a lot of shapes. There are arcs and circles and conics and triangles and polygons. And, you know, there's a lot there. So understanding the shapes and how the point relate to, you know, the lines, all that seems to be something that is programmed into this application. I don't feel like I understand the underlying math lesson, if there is one. I did notice that you can change the coordinate system. So it defaults to Euclidean, but you can also use polar. So I guess that's something. I didn't notice a difference. So I don't know if I'm just not seeing the panel where this stuff is sort of exposed or what, but I didn't see, I was hoping for something really, really exciting. Like it's going to turn the world, you know, upside down and into a parabolic grid or something, and it's just, it didn't really, there hasn't been, I haven't been able to sort of get into what I think should be, I should be able to see behind all of the shapes that I'm drawing. I feel like I have more insight almost into an SVG, because at least then you can see sort of the definition of those shapes. Whereas right now it really is, it's just literal, it's drawings with nodes on them. And as interesting and as entertaining as that was for a little while, after a while, I started to want to understand more about what I was doing, and I just wasn't, I was not able to find that information out. But that could just be because I'm not knowing where to look. But like I say, I did read the handbook. Maybe I missed it. Maybe I just flipped past that part and just completely breezed past it. Either way, though, I think at the very least, bare minimum, I think this would be a great tool for someone teaching geometry. So if you happen to be a math teacher, and I know I have at least two mathematicians who sometimes listen to this show, at least two, possibly three, then this could be really cool. KIG, K-I-G. This could be something where you could demonstrate some of those crazy geometry principles that you're teaching people right here in real time, with really a lot of dynamic sort of movement and resizing and relationships to one another. It's fascinating stuff. But I wasn't able to get much farther than just sort of the basics. Really fascinating application, though. Check it out. Check it out if at all you like shapes or geometry. So there we go. I'm not saving that. I should have saved it and then looked at the file format. Hold on, I'm gonna pause. Okay, I drew a circle and saved the file, and things got a lot more interesting, I have to admit. And I don't mean to be so easy to impress, but this is really cool. So if you save a KIG file out as a document, just save, you know, and it'll ask you what to name it. I called it MyKIG, mykig.kig. Open it up in your favorite text editor. I opened it up in Emacs out of habit, and it's all XML. It's not SVG, and I don't really know SVG well enough to glance at this and decide whether this shares substantially any resemblance to SVG. It doesn't, to me, look a whole lot like SVG, but like I say, I don't really know SVG that well from the XML, so I could just be missing something super obvious. But the doc type is KIG document, so I mean, it's not strictly, and XML is quite strict, it's not strictly SVG. KIG document, axes 1, compatibility version, grid version, coordinate system Euclidean, because this was a fresh document. Data type equals double, or data type equals double, ID equals 1, minus 2.08603, close data, data type double, ID 2, 1.02725, close data. Data type double, ID 3, 0.219751. So those are, that's within sort of this hierarchy element. And let's see how long does this, yeah, so it doesn't go on long. So it's defining the points somewhere there, obviously. It talks about a fixed point. I think I must have made a node somewhere, more or less on accident. I think I had a node somewhere that was not inside of my circle. So that's causing a little bit of confusion here. Shouldn't have done that. But then there's a separate element for the viewport. Or, you know, it's just view in the XML. But I'm assuming that's the canvas that I was seeing. And those are that's the draw. Style equals solid line. Point style equals round. Shown true. Color 0000FF, so RGBB, and then width minus 1, font, Noto Sans. I guess, was there a label? I don't think there's a label there. That's interesting. I guess that's probably a thing, because you can do text labels, so maybe it just defaults to Noto Sans. 10, negative 1, 5, 50, 0000. I could probably think about those values and figure out what they were. Actually, zeros must have something to do with fill, because none of those, no, maybe not, because there's three different solid lines interestingly. And I don't remember, I guess I could just open this back up in KIG to see what, to see the, yeah, no, I don't have a node outside of my circle. It is just this circle there. I've just readjusted it a little bit and saved it again. Open it back up in Emacs and everything has changed. No, not everything has changed. Okay. So the viewport code is describing the style. The actual locations are provided in the hierarchy, the data types, because now it's -3.61129 and 1 and 1. So that's, yeah, that's like defining something. And then there's an object type fixed point, so that's one of the nodes. And then another fixed point, it looks like, which would be the other node. So one is the origin point, one is the circumference marker or whatever, or I guess that would be a radius marker, because yeah, okay, because it goes from center point to outside, so the edge marker. And then there's the circle BCP, which is an object type. Yeah, okay, so I don't think I could reverse engineer this well enough to draw accurately what this is representing, but it's just fascinating. It is so fascinating to see this kind of data represented in a way that, you know, somewhat kind of makes sense. It's very cool. So if you are either a fan of geography or a fan of XML, take a look at KIG. Speaking of things starting with K-I-G, the next application, the final one for this episode, is KIGO, or KIGO, KIGO, K-I-G-O. It really should be KGO, because it is the game of Go. For KDE, okay, go. But for whatever reason, it's Kigo. The weird thing about this game for me, first of all, not the game, the application. The weird thing about the application is that when you first launch it, quite probably it'll give you an error. I got the error, and I assume that's because Slackware doesn't ship with the thing that this application apparently depends upon, and it's. So it's a little bit weird. It's not a lot weird. It's just a little bit weird. You launch it and it doesn't work. And in fact, it says it very helpfully gives you an error at the bottom of your application window saying that you need to install a Go engine. Now, I understand that Go is a game. I've heard of Go. I don't know that I've played it. I believe I know how to play it. So maybe I have played it. But I know what Go is, and when I read that error message, I literally thought they were talking about the Go programming language. And so I clicked on configuration, and I gave it the path to /bin/go, to the Go programming, the Go executable. And I could not understand why it was not recognizing that. Then it occurred to me, I mean, it says right here, for instance, GNU Go. But to me, I just thought, okay, GNU Go. I guess GNU has a version of the Go programming language called GNU Go. No, no, they're not talking about that. This is like XChess or GNU Chess, whatever. This is like a front end for the, in this case, a Go, the game, engine. Just like GNU Chess would be the engine for something like Knights or Kboard or what is it, XChess or whatever. So there are front ends, there's the engine. So KIGO or KIGO or KIGO or KIGO is the front end, the graphical front end for this GNU Go Go engine. Now, I don't have GNU Go installed. I'm honestly not going to install it. It's just not something that I believe that I will use, so I'm not going to bother installing it. I'm sure it is a very, very fun game, and I'm imagining that KIGO is a really good front end for it. But it's just not my, that's not my game. So I will not be installing it to try it. I have seen it. It looks great. If you're a fan of Go, try out KIGO. Let me know how it is as front ends for Go games go. I imagine it's probably quite serviceable. I mean, Knights and Kboard and things like that, they work for chess. So I'm assuming this is probably going to be the same kind of success. But that's what KIGO is. I don't know why it's not called KGO. And there you go. That's the game. And that's the episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.